Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. So much of what we are dealing with today is very triggering, but I want to let you know that today's show is about sexual assault, and it might bring up a lot of uncomfortable feelings or memories for people, and I just want to put that out there before we start today's show. Republicans are still pushing for a vote to confirm Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, despite two women coming forward with allegations that he sexually assaulted them, and the lawyer of a third woman claiming there are allegations that he facilitated gang rapes. Dr. Christine Blasey Ford, a professor at Palo Alto University in California, went public with her previously anonymous accusation of sexual assault against Kavanaugh. She says when he was 17 and she was 15, and they were both at a small house party, Kavanaugh and his friend forced her into a bedroom. Kavanaugh pinned her to a bed and drunkenly tried to remove her clothes, putting a hand over her mouth to stop her from screaming for help. They are both expected to testify this Thursday. As the Senate Judiciary Committee members argue over whether and when, well, actually, the hearing has been scheduled on Thursday. But since then, another accuser came forward. On Sunday, The New Yorker published an account from Deborah Ramirez, who attended Yale University with Kavanaugh. She says that at a very drunk dorm party, Kavanaugh exposed himself to her. Also on Sunday, lawyer Michael Avenetti wrote to the Senate Judiciary Committee alleging he has witnesses willing to testify that Kavanaugh helped facilitate gang rapes of women. Avenetti says one woman will come forward by Thursday. Kavanaugh has denied the allegations. He and his wife conducted an interview on Fox over the weekend. His supporters say he has treated women respectfully. A number of Republicans are still saying this. Senator Mitch McConnell promised on Monday that Kavanaugh would be voted on by the Senate. Now, if he's confirmed, Kavanaugh is widely expected to overturn Roe v. Wade, or at least rule on a decision that would make abortion illegal in many states across the country. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about this moment we are in, and we're talking about the survivors who are coming forward. Today, we're joined by Loretta Ross, an activist who helped create the Reproductive Justice Framework. She is the co-founder of Sister Song, a reproductive justice collective led by women of color. She's also the author of Reproductive Justice and Introduction. And Loretta joins us from Tempe, Arizona. Hi, Loretta. Welcome back to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me on your show.
Well, it's great to have you, Loretta. We're also joined by John Finley, Public Policy Associate with the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault. John joins us from San Diego. Hi, John. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you. Loretta, I want to start off with you. You have been working on these issues for so long, making sure that abortion is safe and legal for women, especially poor women and women of color. How are you reflecting on this moment that we are in?
Well, before I worked on reproductive politics, I actually was the director, the third executive director of the first rape crisis center in this country. So I've been working on ending violence against women even longer than I've been working on protecting women's rights to reproductive freedom. And the two issues dovetail for me very neatly because we're up against a patriarchal society that tells women, first of all, you do not have the right to bodily autonomy. We get to tell you what to do with your body. We get to invade you. We get to rape you. And then we get to lie about it and say that you asked for it or that you were an incredibly slutty person who deserved everything that happened to you. And so we've been up against this patriarchy for a long time. But I actually am not discouraged. Mm-hmm. I actually think things are getting better. Because when the first rape crisis center was founded in 1972, the D.C. one, we just thought we could make a dent in getting people to understand that rape is not okay. Then came the new Me Too movement that said women aren't going to take it anymore. And they're being joined by men who are saying, and no, we're not going to be allowed ourselves to be portrayed as jerks anymore. Mm-hmm. Boys will not just be the good old boys. And so I'm actually encouraged by the fact that changing human hearts and minds is such a slow process. But in my lifetime, I've seen incredible change, because there's not a country in the world where people are not organizing to end violence against women. Hmm. That's a successful transnational movement in my eyes.
Wow, I love you, Loretta. I mean, it's so great to hear that perspective, because, I mean, every day, every hour, it feels like there's something new coming down. And then just reading the hashtag on Twitter, I believe it's I Didn't Report. I mean, these stories are just heartbreaking. And it's amazing that so many women and men are coming forward to share their stories.
I agree. Every time I tell my story publicly, I get a number of people who walk up to me and privately whisper that me telling my story encouraged them to tell their story. I just heard recently from a woman almost 90 years old who told me about being incested back in the 1930s. And I'm the first person she told the story to, because I was the first person she heard tell my own incest story. You never know why people scab over their wounds and are afraid to pull those scabs off. We just have to be there for them when they do, believe them when they do, and don't let these people who leave their dirty fingerprints on their life stories get away with it.
Mm. Well, be sure to check out hashtag I Didn't Report, hashtag I Did Not Report. One woman, I can't participate in the hashtag because I did report, even got a kit done. No follow through from the detective assigned. I literally never heard from police after my ER visit. That's another reason why folks don't report. I'm a living example of it. This is from Steffi Squeeze Play. Jess Bryant, I was asleep, passed out, woke up with my clothes being taken off without me even being conscious. I still believed it was my fault, because that's the world we live in. Even at 18, I knew it was always the woman's fault. I didn't report, and I've never told anyone else ever until now. Wow, Jess Bryant. I mean, the list on Twitter is so, so long. John Finley, you are an associate with the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault. When mm-hmm. you're reflecting, what do you make of the moment we're in right now?
Well, the first thing I'll say is that if anyone listening is a survivor of sexual violence in need of support in any way, the local Rape Crisis Center in San Francisco Women Against Rape, has a 24-hour free and confidential helpline. That number is 415-647-7273. Once again, that's 415-647-7273. And I think the services that agencies like SF Women Against Rape are providing, we're starting to see that the work that has been done for so many years in this movement, from folks, survivors who organized in order to meet the needs of their fellow survivors, of their neighbors, of their friends who have been victims of violence, we are starting to see that those services are getting stronger and that people are using them even more. The National Sexual Assault Hotline, just in the 48 hours after the hashtag Why I Didn't Report started trending on Twitter, received a 42% increase in calls.
Wow.
And that's encouraging to me, but it also shows that we need to support these organizations and we need to support these agencies while we are in the active process of changing our culture to make sure that survivors' voices are heard and that they're being met with a respectful response from their community. We talked about how folks don't want to come forward mostly because of the fear of how the community is going to respond. I think we've seen that response change within the past several months, but it's been the result of work over decades. And I think I'm encouraged by that, but also it's frustrating how it seems like we're still having the same battle that was had in 1991.
Right.
You know, and that's frustrating to folks. But I think we're coming together more, and people are being responsive. People know what to say to somebody who comes forward as a survivor of sexual violence now. The overwhelming response that Dr. Ford got from her home community in Palo Alto is very inspiring. Folks marching in the street in support of her, people saying, I believe Dr. Ford, I support Dr. Ford, it wasn't her fault, and we are here for her as a community. That's change, and that matters.
You brought up a couple points there, John, and I'm so glad you gave us the phone number for the 24-hour rape crisis line in San Francisco. We also air outside of the Bay Area, John. Can anyone across the country call this number?
So the National Sexual Assault Hotline is also available for anyone around the country to call. San Francisco Women Against Rape, that phone number can also redirect folks to the National Sexual Assault Hotline. But that number is 1-800-656-4673.
Okay.
That's 1-800-656-4673, and that's available 24 hours as well.
And I'll give that out throughout the show. To add to that, John, I mean, of course, everyone has a different story. Everyone responds and reacts differently, whether it's the day after 10 or 20 years down the line. What other services are available for people if they want to seek help? Because we did a show about the suicide hotlines, and therapy is very expensive. I mean, we heard from a lot of people who said, I would love to go to therapy, but it's just out of my price range. Do you have any tips for people who might want to get help beyond the national hotline?
All right. So I would say that local rape crisis centers are an excellent resource for anybody who needs help. They offer often free counseling services, and there's also in California the Victims Compensation Board. And so anybody who's a victim of sexual violence in the state of California can apply through the California Victim Compensation Board to receive funding for their counseling services. That's something that the state of California does that's very, very helpful for survivors of sexual violence. And local rape crisis centers can assist survivors in getting access to those funds and getting access to those services. So my first advice is to always call your local rape crisis center. It doesn't have to be reporting to police. We know there are many reasons why a victim of sexual violence may not want to report publicly, may not want to go to police. We're seeing it all over Twitter. But rape crisis centers are responsive to the needs of survivors and can assist them the entire length of the process, whether that's getting a medical exam done, whether it's choosing to go to the police, or it's just filing for a claim within the Victims Compensation Board. A local rape crisis center is an extraordinary ally, and I would always recommend calling them.
Do you know if there are victim compensation funds in other states across the country?
You know, I believe there are. I'm not familiar with how their processes work. I know in California, the Victim Compensation Board is specifically designed to make sure that victims of any form of crime can get compensation for what's going on. But specifically, they're paying more and more attention to sexual assault in the state of California. And that's been the result of the advocacy that has been going on for years to get the Victim Compensation Board to really pay attention to that issue here in California.
Loretta, do you know, I mean, as the director of the third rape crisis center in the country, what other resources are available for survivors?
I don't know what other resources are available through victim compensation boards, but I do know that there's a vibrant network of people who tell their stories and really question whether or not reporting to police is the best option. I'm glad that that was problematized, because so often people get re-victimized in the reporting. Mm. But what people can do as survivors is that we can do documentation, even if we don't do reporting. And documentation can include telling another person, writing a diary entry, creating the evidentiary trail to prove your story, even if you don't go to the police. Because I don't want us to get into assuming that increasing the prison industrial complex is a solution towards ending violence against women and boys and girls. We can't fall into that law and order trap, because most rapes are not reported. There's even worse underreporting if the victim is a male. And so we can't use the rubric of have you reported as evidence of whether it's true or not.
And to that point, on the hashtag Why I Didn't Report, so many women are talking about, and men, about how they wouldn't be believed or were not believed, how they felt shame, how they might not have realized what happened to them with sexual assault. Loretta, what other factors should be considered when it comes to, you know, maybe going public or not calling the police, but maybe going to a local authority to let them know what happened, especially if it was recent? What other factors should be considered?
This is where intersectionality matters, because we cannot use as a standard the person will not suffer further consequences if they choose to report, if they choose to go to the police. If it's an incest survivor, it may be the person will be made homeless if they choose to speak out. If it's happening within their family, they may be estranged from all of their relatives who could provide a supportive environment. If it happens within universities, we're seeing through these Title IX complaints, it is the students who are victimized who actually suffer worse punishments often than the people who are the perpetrators, because campuses are not handling sexual assault violations well in protecting both the person who was assaulted and the person who was accused. And then we have Betsy DeVos even weakening those protections. So use intersectionality to make sure that we don't increase the harm and risk that a person experiences when we want them to take care of themselves, to have a self-care plan, to get the support that they need. But we can't just assume that they should follow A, B, C, and D steps because we have no idea what their lived experiences are or the context in which they're having those experiences.
John, what would you add?
All right. I would also add, rape, I think on college campuses in particular, I came to this work actually, the movement sort of picked me up on its way through our society. I was the student body president at Stanford University when an athlete named Brock Turner raped a woman unconscious behind a dumpster outside a frat party at Stanford. And it really rocked our campus, but the response that students, individual student activists, and students who had been already mobilizing around this issue gave, that really galvanized our campus around the issue of sexual assault. And we were able to make systemic changes within our own institution as a result of responding to the work that activists were doing and uplifting the conversation around campus sexual assault. So changes can be made as a result of responding to an individual act. And that is something that I really hope can come, and it's why I thank Dr. Ford so much for sharing her story, even though she actually wanted privacy. She actually didn't want to go public originally, and the moment has kind of, the response that people have given, not respecting her privacy, not respecting her or her story, has called her to an action, and it's called our communities to action, and we can see specific institutional changes that respond to that call. We were able to change our adjudication process at Stanford University. We were able to provide more educational prevention support, so in dorm educational programs where students will be talking more constructively about this issue. And we can start to see our culture change when we really both invest and take seriously responses like that, that aren't just responding to an individual action, but rising it to a higher response of taking sexual assault seriously in our communities. And I really hope that that's what folks get from the hearing that's going to take place on Thursday. I would hope instead of laser focusing on trying to question Dr. Ford, because Dr. Ford is not at all on trial, I would hope that individual senators and supporters of these senators really reflect on what they've done, what they've tolerated in their own culture, what they tolerated at their prep schools when they were hanging out with their buddies and encouraging reckless drinking, And so I really hope that people start to reflect on our own actions and what we're willing to tolerate as a result of this cultural moment.
John Finley is...
I would also...
Oh, go ahead, Loretta.
I would also say that while we need to focus on sexual assault and the way that is being revealed in this judicial nomination process, we need to pull the lens back and say, we're seeing a group of people who will do anything to hang on to immoral power. That this was a larger framework of trying to ram Kavanaugh down our throat so that he can attack voting rights, abortion rights, free speech, all kinds of things. So we can't just focus on only one axis of their agenda and think that we are describing the whole train wreck that's happening to our democracy. It's an attack on the media. It's attack on voting. It's attack on women's rights. It's attack on bodily autonomy, on democratic institutions. We need to connect those dots because our enemies are working from an intersectional playbook, and we need to be equally intersectional.
Loretta Ross is an activist who helped create the reproductive justice framework. She directed the third rape crisis center in the country. She's
actually reversed that. I was the third director of the first rape crisis.
Thank you. Thank you. Third director of the first rape crisis center in the country. She is co-founder of Sister Song, a reproductive justice collective led by women of color, co-author of Reproductive Justice and Introduction, and author of Undivided Rights, Women of Color Organized for Reproductive Justice. She wrote that along with a number of other women. We're also joined by John Finley, Public Policy Associate with the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault. And if you'd like to join us, what do you make of the moment that we are in? And if you'd like to add to any of the points that Loretta and John are making, if you are a survivor, if you've shared your story, what do you make of all the stories that you're reading and hearing? I mean, there's just so much to talk about. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Loretta, can you elaborate on what you just said about Trump and the Republicans doing a great job of connecting the dots? Can you elaborate more on that?
Well, in fact, I think they are representing a segment of the population that is demographically doomed. In 20 or 30 years, white men will not be the majority of the people in this country or the majority of the people who can vote. So they are attacking voting rights. They're attacking citizenship claims. They're attacking women's rights. Largely, I think, try to encourage white women into having more babies, because I'm not convinced that they care about the brown and black babies that are already here. Look what they're doing to them. But it's all about the naked drive towards an apartheid-like state so that a small minority of people can violate democracy and maintain power. That's what they're trying to do. Nancy McLean describes it wonderfully in her book, Democracy in Chains, how this plan started 50 or 60 years ago. Yeah. And yet so many of us are just now catching up to it when we, quote, woke up in 2016. Mm. We need to take a longitudinal view. We need to connect up the dots between the attacks on the media or education or, you know, the attack on colleges, trying to persuade people that being consumers and mindless consumers and paying attention to the politics and the economics of the day is not worth their time. We really have a large agenda here. And I don't loosely use the word fascist because I'm a student of the fascist movement. I've studied it a lot. But at the same time, I think there are enough elements of a proto-fascist movement present in American society that we all need to be alarmed and say, wait a moment, this isn't just about abortion rights. This isn't just about immigrants. This isn't just about LGBT rights. This is about how an embattled minority of white men hold on to illegitimate power forever.
Mm. Anything to add, John, before we go to break?
I think Loretta covered that.
Yeah. Well, and Nancy McLean's book is incredible. We've had her on twice. We had her on last week talking about Democracy in Chains, and you can find that interview at yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about sexual assault, what is happening with a Supreme Court nominee, Brett Kavanaugh. Two women have come forward with allegations that he sexually assaulted them. A lawyer, Michael Avenetti, says that another woman will come forward by Thursday to talk about how he helped facilitate gang rapes of women. And Kavanaugh and Dr. Christine Blasey Ford are expected to testify on Thursday. And you can bet that so many things are going to be happening and dropping between now and then. Today, we're joined by John Finley, Public Policy Associate with the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault. Loretta Ross was the third director of the first rape crisis center in the country, and she's co-author of Reproductive Justice and Introduction. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. We just got an email from Emily who says, Can you talk more about the McDonald's strikes around Me Too? I feel like they're not getting the coverage they deserve. Well, Emily, we are going to be talking about this issue tomorrow. McDonald's workers across the country walked off the job to tell the company no more sexual harassment. And a couple weeks ago, California janitors marched from San Francisco to Sacramento to support a statewide bill that would strengthen sexual violence prevention procedures for janitors who often face harassment and assault when they work the night shifts in isolation. So we will talk about how low-wage women workers and women of color are demanding protections and they're demanding an end to systemic sexual harassment. That is on tomorrow's Your Call. Today, we are talking in a related show about sexual harassment and survivors telling their stories, about how Republicans are still pushing for a vote to confirm Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh. Two women have come forward with allegations that he sexually assaulted them. Lawyer Michael Avenatti says another woman is going to come forward by Thursday. If you have any questions or comments on this, the hashtag, why I didn't report, if you have a story you'd like to share, if you've been working on these issues for decades, what are your thoughts about the moment that we are in? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Loretta, you already touched on this. The conversation needs to be much bigger and needs to do a better job of connecting the dots. But what else do you think is missing? Because what's striking to me and is a little overwhelming is just all of the news that's being kind of broken on social media. You know, reporters fighting with each other, and there's just still so much. And when we kind of pull back from all of that, what do you think is missing from this conversation?
Well, I think part of the missing voice is the role of both people who are experts in sexual violence who can deconstruct the type of defense that Kavanaugh is using. Mm. Most reporters are not specialists like we are. We know what is the classic first step, what is this classic second step, on and on and on, because we've been watching this stuff for decades. There are experts who are available in sexual violence and sexual harassment law that rarely get called upon to be in the media, because they tend to go for the pundits of the day, the talking points, and quite often they just give too much airtime and credibility to elite white men just because of their identity, not because they have anything substantive to offer. There's so much, so I want to first offer a critique of the media. I also want to offer a critique of the studied cynicism of those of us who don't think it's our responsibility to be accountable for the privilege we have as Americans. Yeah. We have the privilege to speak up, to vote, to participate in shaping our democracy. I remember getting into a discussion the other day at my barbershop. I asked the guy whether he was going to vote, and he says, "No, I'm not. I'm going to let the Lord take care of that." And I sat there stunned, trying to figure out, what do you say? Is this just faith or stupidity or a combination of the two? What do you say to that? So there's a cynicism, a fatalism that we need to overcome on our side. We have to get out of this call-out culture where we're busy critiquing our allies' strategies as opposed to staying united so we can focus on our opponents. There's so much we can do. But first of all, we need to, how did the student put it once? She said, we got to turn me search into research. We need to know more than just about how we feel and what our opinions are. I love that thought. Let's turn me search into research.
That's great.
Find out more.
Yeah. So true. John, what would you add?
I would also add that not only in the context of sexual assault survivors, but also women more broadly, folks who have been left out of the political process, we are a political constituency. And when you see Me Too becoming a political wedge issue, when you see sexual harassment, sexual assault, exploitation of women, treatment, sexual abuse of children, these sorts of things becoming political talking points and political footballs. That means that folks who are most directly impacted by those issues also have to be politically organized and ready to take on the political response that's going to come. We are actually very loosely connected in terms of political mobilization. We have folks who are survivors in our communities who are not connected to each other. And that's what the Me Too movement was founded to be. When Tarana Burke started the Me Too movement, it was not as an effort to call out men. It was as an effort to bring survivors together and unite them under one voice to let you know there's a community here for you and we're going to be together in this. And that's what Me Too is all about. And so I think that making sure that politically, if this issue is going to be a political one, then we have to be ready to respond politically also. And that's something that is still missing from the conversation. I think it's starting to appear, though. And that's something that while we do that, we have to make sure we're continuing to be sensitive to the voices of survivors and respectful of their stories. We can't launch stories and raise stories up just because they might give a political benefit. That's something we have to be careful of doing while we organize in order to make sure we're responding to the political moment. We can't use people as political capital, as a political weapon. Mm. And so that's something we have to be very sensitive about and respectful towards, but also recognize what the moment is calling for. It's calling for organization, calling for mobilization, and it's calling for our collective voice and our collective power.
Well, we saw a lot of mobilization over the weekend. 125 people were arrested yesterday protesting Brett Kavanaugh. And then across the country, students walked out from high schools mm-hmm. to colleges. In one case, a group of high school boys took to the streets to support Christine Blasey Ford and Deborah Ramirez. What are your thoughts about that?
We have to connect all of these thoughts because I love the high school students that are protesting gun violence, the high school students that are taking a knee to talk about police brutality mm-hmm. and supporting Colin Kaepernick. I love the ones that are saying, I was 15 and I wouldn't want this to happen to me. I mean, they live so immersed and seamless between issues in a way that we could learn from them mm-hmm. how to connect up our social justice movements and things. But I wanted to speak to a point about what will be the response of our social justice human rights movement. We're going to have more people running for office. I saw a news report yesterday talking about a pink wave of more women running for office, more progressive men running for office, because for too long, men have been willing to run for office on part of our demands and then throw a lot of our demands, mostly women's rights, under the bus as they try to secure our votes. And we've started fighting back and say, no, you cannot trade one set of my human rights for another set of my human rights and expect to get my undivided support. I'm going to help elect you, and I'm going to hold you accountable once you're elected. That's how we have to be. We have to learn how to play, I guess this is an oxymoron, loving hardball. We can't be as crude as our opponents. As a matter of fact, let me just talk from my abortion rights activism. We are used to protecting the privacy of the people who walk into our clinics because a lot of those protesters outside of our clinics send their daughters in to get services. And because they know we will protect their confidentiality. We will never use people's lives as political football as the way our opponents do. We have a higher set of ethics than mm-hmm. that. And we're serving a perfect cause. We're imperfect people, but we're serving the perfect cause of justice. And so we don't have to go low just because they do.
Hmm. Well, and since you brought this up, Loretta, since you've done so much work around abortion and reproductive rights, there was a pretty disturbing segment on the PBS NewsHour last week, excellent report, how the next Supreme Court justice could affect your access to birth control. And they focused on this kind of new clinic that's out there called Obria. And it's basically a, quote, natural family planning clinic. And they want to be the counter to Planned Parenthood. They talk about sex. They offer all kinds of services, but no birth control. They advocate natural family planning and say if you don't want to get pregnant, don't have sex on these few days a month. And they're getting like $250 million in funding. So what are your thoughts about this?
It is not an original story that Republicans who are anti-sex will support anti-sex clinics.
Right.
They just do that. They upgrade their branding, but not their ethics or their messages. That's what they do. Now, women are not going to be largely persuaded that the rhythm method is the most effective birth control method. And because if they get it wrong, guess who pays the price? Matter of fact, I think that's why there's no effectively marketed male birth control pill, because what woman would trust a guy who says, oh, I've got this, I'm covered, you don't have to take care. I mean, it's just not going to work. And so this is another slick branding, rebranding campaign into trying to dupe people into thinking that the rhythm method is superior to all other methods, which simply it is not. Most people don't even know enough about their bodies to effectively use the rhythm method. Matter of fact, if you wanted people to use the rhythm method, you need to start evidence-based sex education so that they know how to track their menses and their cycles and know what discharge looks like and all of those things. But if you're not offering that information, they're going to be bad rhythm-based contraceptors, I would suspect.
Mm-hmm.
It's just another slick way of. I think the problem is that we're not as dumb as they wish we were. They hope that we allow this kind of slick neoliberal marketing and trading away of our rights to pass by without opposition, and we just won't let them do it.
Mm. Loretta Ross is an activist who helped create the Reproductive Justice Framework, co-author of Reproductive Justice, An Introduction, and she's the third director of the first rape crisis center in the country. John Finley is public policy associate with the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault. And let's hear from a caller. Let's go to... my cursor's not working here. Nancy in Berkeley. Hi, Nancy. Welcome to the show.
Hi.
Hi, Nancy. Go ahead.
I just have a comment. Brett Kavanaugh came up yesterday with what I thought was the most ridiculous excuse I've ever heard for why he couldn't possibly have done this to these women, and that was because he was a virgin. Now, I was just flabbergasted at this excuse. It was, my feeling is that if he had been getting sex, he wouldn't be doing this to these women. Not that he wasn't getting it, because it seems to me that for some reason or another, he said he hadn't had sex in many, many years, when he was in college or years afterwards. And it seems to me that if he had been getting sex, you know, as I said, he wouldn't be doing it to these women. But because he hadn't been getting it, and he had some, obviously, you know, desires that are being repressed, he had to take it out in these ways. To me, that's just a more indicative that he would do this to these women.
Mm. Well, again, that came out on a Fox interview. He said, quote, I did not have sexual intercourse or anything close to sexual intercourse in high school or for many years thereafter. The girls were from the schools I went to and I were friends. End quote. Fox News host Martha McCallum said, through all these years that were in question, you were a virgin? He said, that's correct. He replied, he did not have sex until many years after college. John, okay, let's say that's true. What does that have to do with the sexual assault?
Absolutely nothing. and Nancy, you know, you pointed out what was really the most disgraceful part of what I thought was Judge Kavanaugh's words when he says, because he was a virgin, he must have never sexually assaulted anyone. You know, that kind of violent thinking really stems from ignorance. It reminded me of when Brock Turner and his attorneys filed an appeal, and they were talking about how he couldn't possibly be convicted of rape because it wasn't sexual intercourse, it was sexual outercourse, which is just the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard in my life. And so I think what this really stems from is a kind of willful ignorance, choosing not to understand that sexual assault and sexual intercourse are not the same thing, and also hoping that Fox News viewers will ignore the fact that the vast majority of sexual assault happens between friends and acquaintances. As Loretta pointed out, they really think that people are dumber than they are, and will respond to that with a, oh, well, that couldn't have possibly happened. Brett Kavanaugh says he was a virgin. Sexual intercourse and sexual assault are not the same thing, and all kinds of sexual violence can be inflicted on somebody, especially between teenagers, without sexual intercourse taking place. And it's astounding that Brett Kavanaugh thought that going on and saying that he was a virgin publicly on Fox News would somehow absolve him of any accusation of sexual misconduct or sexual violence. That really has nothing whatsoever to do with it. But it also underscores our own society's willful ignorance of what sexual assault even is. It underscores our total ineptitude at having anything close to an empathetic conversation about it. We really just have so much work to do, men in particular. It's shameful how unwilling we are to do it and how we cling to the lowest common denominator excuse every single time. It's frustrating, to be honest.
Mm. What would you add, Loretta?
But it wasn't an accident that he chose that defense. I mean, he's trying to describe himself as the person standing up for virtue, and all his critics as agents of evil. He is really carefully framing himself as a defender of honesty, integrity, and virtue, and everybody else is evil, slutty, has an agenda, et cetera, et cetera. So rape is never about sex. It's about power. It is always about power. And so whether or not you successfully penetrated a girl before a given age is irrelevant. The fact that you felt so insecure that you had to exert power over another person, but whether it's in chain gangs or chain rapes like they described, or you just had to have your buddy in the room so that he could see you overpowering somebody, that's a testament to your male insecurity. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with whether or not you're able to have penetrative sex. I mean, really. And part of the problem that I have is that a lot of people who are criticizing us for calling attention to sexual violence and sexual assault and changing toxic masculinity think that we're doing it so that we can embarrass men, that we can change what male culture is. Well, we are trying to change what male culture is, but we're also not trying to embarrass men. But the reality is that if this was just about embarrassing early male sexual adventures, I mean, no guy would ever have sex with a woman because a woman would be too continually laughing at them. which is their greatest fear, according to Margaret Atwood.
This isn't about fire today.
Well, it's not about challenging sexual immaturity or harshly punishing people for not knowing how to have pornographic-like great sex. It's about challenging the misuses and abuses of power. And we're going to keep reinforcing that. We're not going to descend to the gutter talking about when does your next hard-on happen. We're talking about when your abuse of power begins to concretize as your elite right, even in high school.
It's so true. And I just want to add on the virgin comment. Jane Mayer, who co-wrote the piece about Deborah Ramirez in The New Yorker, tweeted, "Another Yale classmate rebuts Kavanaugh. Was he lying then or last night on Fox? This classmate, Steve Kantrowitz, is an award-winning history professor. Steve quoted or tweeted, perhaps Brett Kavanaugh was a virgin for many years after high school, but he claimed otherwise in a conversation with me during our freshman year in Lawrence Hall at Yale in the living room of my suite." Okay, so that's getting retweeted and retweeted. But your point is so important, Loretta, the bigger picture here. I mean, we've got, you know, Donald Trump, who's accused of sexual assault, who on a tape says he grabs you-know-what. He confirms or he nominates Brett Kavanaugh, who is now accused of sexual assault by two women. Michael Avenatti says a credible woman's going to come and speak by Thursday. This man, Brett Kavanaugh, could be the deciding vote to possibly overturn Roe within less than a year because 13 abortion cases are already before circuit courts across the country. Last step before reaching the Supreme Court. So what about that, Loretta? I mean, again, going back to connect all the dots.
Well, I do think that they're teeing him up to overturn Roe, but also to protect President Trump from the Mueller investigation. Let's not lose sight of that.
Mm-hmm.
That is not an accident. That these are not separate stories. These are interconnected stories. That he needs that Supreme Court seat to protect himself from investigations into his financial and electoral crimes. And so let's not just say this is just about abortion or this is just about sexual assault. This is about holding the most powerful person in an elected office accountable for his high crimes and misdemeanors. That's why they're so anxious to get that seventh seat. I think abortion politics is just one of those cultural wars issues that they push as a distraction in many ways, mm-hmm. because their real agenda is to establish an apartheid-like state here.
Well, I want to end by talking about survivors. And, John, Christine Blasey Ford, I mean, when her accusations became public, she immediately was the target of death threats. She has been criticized, dismissed, blamed. According to reports, she is living separately from her children because of everything that's going on right now. The Washington Post had a piece about how she moved 3,000 miles away from Maryland, where she says Kavanaugh assaulted her at a house party. And then her husband said she even thought about moving to New Zealand. She said, quote, or her husband said, quote, she was like, I can't deal with this. If he becomes the nominee, I'm moving to another country. I cannot live in this country if he's in the Supreme Court. She wanted out. So that's Dr. Ford. But we hear stories from so many women from across the range, from across the economic spectrum, who talk about how they were vilified in their communities, how they were not believed, how their rape kit sat for years and nothing happened. So can you talk just a little bit about why people either do not come forward or come forward 5-10 years later?
So there are many reasons a survivor of sexual violence may not come forward immediately after an attack has taken place, the most obvious being it's immediately after an attack has taken place. There's so many effects of trauma. The effects of trauma are severe. There's significant trauma associated with sexual violence both the immediate after the attack and also long-term. Anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, loss of self-esteem, depression. But the most immediate feeling that a survivor often feels is that this is my fault, and if I tell anybody, that's what they're going to say. The self-blame, that's common. Survivors need to know that there's a space where their story will be respected, where they will be respected, and where they'll be believed. And I think Dr. Ford really saw that didn't exist for her for so long. People are saying, well, why did it take her so long to do this? Why didn't she report it until now? And yet this is the response she gets the day she reports it. I think it's pretty obvious why she wouldn't have done it before now, because the same response would have been likely to happen 30 years ago. And that's something that our culture has to change, and we have to be more respectful and more receptive to the stories of survivors. On the flip side, it becomes complicated when people that we know, people we trust, people we even admire, the reality is people commit sexual violence, and it touches every single industry in this country. It touches every community. It's people we know that are doing this harm onto other members of our community. So it's imperative that we continue to hold those who commit sexual violence accountable, regardless of their position in the community, their positions of power, their fame, their wealth, whatever. We have to hold them accountable for the harm that they committed, and we have to make sure that survivors feel okay coming forward. We're not quite at that place yet. And the vicious response that Dr. Ford has received, the vicious responses that Deborah Ramirez has received, those underscore why it's so difficult for a survivor to come forward, especially when the person they're coming forward against holds such a position of power. Mm. And Brett Kavanaugh, you know, he is, if he were to be confirmed on the Supreme Court, he's moving from the D.C. Court of Appeals to the Supreme Court of the United States. In my opinion, it's actually not at all odd that somebody would move away from D.C. and forget who was on the D.C. Court of Appeals. it's not really that salient to us in the state of California, who is on the D.C. Court of Appeals. And so people saying, well, he was in a position of power for a long time. Why didn't you say anything until now? He's just been nominated to the Supreme Court 2 months ago. I didn't know who Brett Kavanaugh was until 2 months ago, and I consider myself to be a bit of a policy nerd. A lot of people didn't really know. And I think that speaks to how you try to remove the pain and the trauma from your life. There was one tweet on the hashtag Why I Didn't Report that said, I just wanted to move on. I didn't want to be defined by it. I didn't want it to define me or to hold power over my life anymore. And I thought if I didn't talk about it, I could grow past it. That's such a common feeling, and that's why we as a community really need to say, no, we're here with you. And whenever you're ready, we will stand to meet you, and we'll stand together with you, and we'll march with you, and we will hold Brett Kavanaugh accountable. Our community has to say that to Dr. Ford and to all the survivors out there of sexual violence.
Thank you for that. Loretta, we have about a minute left. Your final thoughts?
Well, first of all, thank you for having me on your show. And I like the fact that this political moment has given us a chance to do something differently, and that is to enlarge our human rights movement and bring people together to say no.
Loretta Ross is an activist who helped create the reproductive justice framework. She was the third director of the first rape crisis center in the country. She's co-author of Reproductive Justice, an Introduction, and other very important books. Loretta, as always, thank you so much for your work. We'd love to have you back soon.
Thank you.
Thank you. John Finley is public policy associate with the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault. John, thank you for your work. We'd love to have you back to talk more about what's happening on college campuses across the country.
Thank you very much. I'd love to come back.
Thank you. Thank you for your work. I want to acknowledge that we got an email from a listener who says, my family was stalked 6 years ago by a relative. The stalking involved violent sexual threats. My wife tried to get victims' compensation to cover her therapy, lost wages, medical bills. That process was a nightmare. In California, they make it so difficult to even apply for compensation that it only adds to the victim's stress and anger. She never received any compensation. We're also getting other emails about therapy and access, and we're definitely going to do a show specifically about what resources are available for survivors, whether it's people who've been assaulted or have been in other traumatic experiences. It's so important. The national hotline, the national rape hotline, is 800-656-4673. Again, the number is 800-656-4673, and we will do a show in the near future about what resources are available for people. And I hope you can join us tomorrow. We will talk about the changes that low-wage women workers are demanding to protect themselves and to end systemic sexual harassment. Thanks so much to Laura Wenis for producing today's show. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.